Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome, everyone. Today, we're diving into a book that's, well, quite something. Jan Martell's Life of Pi. It's this incredible mix of high seas, adventure, and really deep philosophical questions.
It really is. And it's fascinating how Martell's own background kind of informs the whole thing. You know, he's Canadian, but his parents were diplomats, so he grew up all over the world.
Right. So that likely gave him that focus on identity, belief, reality.
Yeah.
How fluid those things can be.
Exactly. It feels like that's baked into the novel's DNA.
And it certainly made an impact. Published back in 2001, then boom, the Booker Prize in 2002. People talk about it as adventure, survival.
Sure, it's got all that. Yeah. But it's also, you know, a spiritual journey, a Bildungsroman, that coming of age structure where the main character grows through hardship.
Definitely. So our goal today, I think, is to unpack that core idea, how storytelling itself, the way we frame our experiences, becomes this vital tool for, well, survival, for making sense of it all.
Couldn't put it better myself. It's all about the power of narrative.
Okay, let's set the scene. We start in Pondicherry, India, in the 70s. Meet Pasin Malitor Patel.
Named after a swimming pool in Paris, of all things.
Right. And he shows this knack for shaping reality early on. He has this unfortunate nickname.
Pissing Patel. Awful.
Which is awful. So he takes control. He rebrands himself as Pi, like the mathematical constant. It's his first real power move, defining himself.
And his whole foundation is built on these two almost opposing forces, wouldn't you say? His father, Santosh.
The zoo owner, very rational, wants Pi to see the harsh reality.
And he teaches him this lesson that's just brutal, making Pi watch a tiger kill and eat a goat.
Just to hammer home that animals aren't sentimental, they're instinct, raw nature.
But then you have his mother, Gita. She's the counterpoint, right? Nurturing his spiritual side.
And Pi just runs with it. He doesn't just pick one faith. He dives into Hinduism, Christianity, and Islam all at once.
He's searching everywhere. And when the religious leaders confront him, you know, tell him he has to choose, his answer is so simple, so pure.
I just want to love God.
Exactly. It's not about dogma for him. It's about the connection itself.
But you could argue, couldn't you, that embracing everything means committing to nothing? Isn't part of faith that exclusive leap?
Well, that's the rationalist view, maybe. But for Pi, I think it's about seeing the shared core, the universal love behind the different rules. He holds these seemingly contradictory ideas together.
And that mental flexibility, that's crucial for what's coming.
Absolutely essential.
Yeah.
Because that peaceful, eclectic life gets shattered. Political trouble in India means the family have to leave, sell the zoo, pack up.
Head for Canada. And this leads them to board a Japanese cargo ship, the Simsim.
Loaded with family and animals, sailing towards a new life.
The classic setup for something terrible to happen, unfortunately.
And it does. The whole world just collapses.
Right. Let's get into the main conflict. The shipwreck. It's sudden, violent.
Yeah, the Simsim goes down in a storm. No real explanation given, just chaos. Pi gets thrown overboard, ends up in a lifeboat. A standard 26-footer.
And his family. Gone. Just like that. The trauma is instantaneous. Total.
And the name of the ship, Simsim. You mentioned its significance.
Yes. In Kabbalah, it refers to God, sort of. Contracting, pulling back to make space for creation, for the finite world.
Wow. So literally Pi's world contracts around him, shrinks down to this tiny, terrifying space.
And who's in that space with him? It's unbelievable. A zebra with a broken leg.
An orangutan, orange juice, apparently floated over on a bunch of bananas.
A really vicious hyena.
And then the big reveal. Hidden under the boat's tarpaulin, Richard Parker, a 450-pound Bengal tiger.
The stage is set for this grim spectacle. The allegory begins right away with the animals.
It's pure, raw nature. The hyena, cowardly but cruel, torments the injured zebra, eats it alive. Horrific.
Orange juice, maybe representing Pi's mother or just maternal instinct. She tries to fight back.
But the hyena kills her too. Just awful. Feels like total despair, total chaos.
Until Richard Parker makes his entrance, he emerges. And bam, kills the hyena instantly.
So a kind of order is restored, but it's the order of terror. Now Pi's alone, just him and the tiger.
And this crystallizes the core struggle, doesn't it? It's not just about finding food and water. It's this internal battle. Pi, the gentle vegetarian boy, versus the savage necessity of survival embodied by the tiger.
Yeah, how does he survive that? It leads us straight into the long journey, 227 days at sea. It's about endurance, but also massive psychological change.
Okay, but wait. Taming a tiger on a lifeboat. How is that even remotely possible? Where does he start?
Well, not exactly taming in the circus sense. It's about establishing dominance, creating boundaries, and he actually uses the knowledge his father gave him, that harsh zoo knowledge.
So the rationalism comes back into play.
Exactly. He knows raw fear will kill him faster than the tiger.
Yeah.
So first step, build a tiny raft, tether it to the lifeboat, creates a safety zone, sort of.
A buffer.
Okay, a physical separation.
And then psychological warfare, almost. Using a whistle, rocking the boat to create seasickness, controlling the food supply. It's classical animal training, asserting himself as the alpha, the provider.
He makes Richard Parker dependent on him. It's this bizarre, necessary symbiosis.
Totally. And the cost is huge for Pi. He has to dish his vegetarianism, his pacifism. He becomes a hunter, kills fish, turtles.
He has to embrace the tiger within himself to manage the tiger in the boat.
Right. And that relationship shifts. Starts as pure terror, obviously. But Richard Parker becomes, well, a reason to live. Taking care of the tiger, focusing on that task, stops Pi from just giving up. It's this weird, paradoxical companionship.
And the journey gets even stranger. There are these episodes that feel almost hallucinatory.
Oh, definitely. Like the encounter with the blind Frenchman. Pi himself is temporarily blind from malnourishment.
And he hears this voice, thinks it's another castaway. They talk, share their misery.
But when the Frenchman comes aboard, Pi's boat. Turns out he's planning to kill and eat Pi. Cannibalism.
It's rock bottom. Human desperation turning truly monstrous.
And who saves Pi? Richard Parker. The tiger kills the Frenchman. It's a shocking moment. The animal savagery is almost cleaner than the humankind there.
Then there's the island. The floating carnivorous island.
Unbelievable, right? Seems like paradise at first. Made of edible algae, freshwater ponds, thousands of meerkats living there.
A safe haven. But it's a trap.
A deadly one. Pi discovers the island turns acidic at night, digesting everything. He finds a human tooth inside one of the plant fruits.
It's like a symbol of false faith, maybe a seductive comfort that ultimately consumes you if you stay.
That's a great reading. It tells him he can't just hide away. He has to keep moving, keep striving towards actual salvation, back to the human world. He has to leave.
And throughout all this, that color orange keeps popping up, doesn't it? The life jacket, the tarpaulin, orange juice, the orangutan.
Yeah, it's like this beacon. Orange is hope, survival, buoyancy, floating on that vast, terrifying blue ocean of despair.
Okay, so after 227 days, landfall, Mexico, the ordeal is seemingly over.
But the emotional climax is still coming, and it's heartbreaking.
Richard Parker.
Richard Parker just walks off the boat into the jungle, doesn't look back. No goodbye, no acknowledgement of their shared journey. Nothing.
And Pi is devastated by this. The lack of closure, the sheer animal indifference after everything they went through.
It's brutal. But symbolically, maybe it means that the savage part of himself, the Richard Parker he needed to survive, it isn't needed anymore now that he's back in civilization. It just recedes, vanishes back into the jungle of his unconscious.
But the story isn't finished. There's the big twist.
Right, the interview. Two officials from the Japanese Ministry of Transport, Mr. Okamoto and Mr. Chiba. They're investigating the Simpsons sinking.
And they listen to Pi's story, the piger, the island, all of it, and they just don't buy it.
They find it completely unbelievable. Impossible, they say. The floating bananas, the carnivorous island. It's too fantastical for their report.
They push him. They need a story without the fantasy, something plausible, something factual for the record.
So Pi gives them another story, a short one. Brutal. Human.
No animals this time. On the lifeboat, it was Pi, his mother.
A sailor with a broken leg.
And the ship's cook, a truly horrible man.
In this version, the cook kills the injured sailor for food and then later kills Pi's mother.
And Pi, pushed beyond endurance, finally kills the cook and uses his remains to survive.
It's horrific. But then the connection clicks.
The officials realize it too. The parallels are exact.
The cruel cook is the hyena. The suffering sailor is the zebra. His gentle mother is orange juice.
And Richard Parker. The deadly, magnificent tiger who ultimately kept Pi alive but also committed violence.
That's Pi himself. His own capacity for savagery, the instinct he had to embrace to survive the unsurvivable.
So the animal story wasn't a lie, exactly. It was a metaphor, a necessary one.
A shield. A way to process the horror without letting it destroy him completely. He externalized the brutality onto the animals, especially the tiger, so he could live with himself.
Which brings us right to the heart of the book, the question Martel poses to us through Pi. After telling both stories, Pi asks the officials.
So which story do you prefer? Which is the better story?
Not which story is true. Which is better?
And the officials, after a moment, choose the story with the animals. They admit it's the better story.
And Martel's point seems to be that maybe the literal, factual truth isn't always the most important thing. Maybe the truth that allows us to find meaning, beauty, wonder, even faith. Maybe that's the truth we need to live.
The tiger story takes unimaginable suffering and transforms it into something mythic, almost bearable, an epic of survival and connection, instead of just sordid violence.
And Pi connects this choice directly to faith, doesn't he? He says, and so it goes with God.
Yeah, choosing the better story, the one with wonder and meaning, is like choosing faith itself. It's a leap beyond just the cold, hard facts.
He's quite critical of just staying in doubt, isn't he? That quote about agnosticism.
Oh, yeah. To choose doubt as a philosophy of life is akin to choosing immobility as a means of transportation. Basically saying doubt gets you nowhere. You have to choose a story, choose a belief, make that leap to move forward.
And the name, Richard Parker, a human name for this wild creature. It constantly underscores that blurring line, that duality.
Exactly. It's not about eliminating the beast within, but about acknowledging it, managing it, using it when you absolutely must, and then, crucially, knowing when to let it go.
I think Life of Pi stays with people because it hits that nerve about how we construct our own realities. The facts of life might be brutal, but the stories we tell ourselves about them, that's where we find the strength to carry on.
It really champions our ability to create meaning, even out of horror. It's an act of profound resilience.
It makes you think, though. Richard Parker gave Pi a reason to live for 227 days. But it was his abrupt, unsentimental departure that really allowed Pi to become fully human again. Does real healing, real closure, sometimes require that kind of clean break? That lack of sentimentality when letting go of the traumatic past, letting that savage self just disappear?
That's a really provocative thought to end on. Does closure need to be unsentimental?
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Apatra Foundation.